You're listening to Road to Black Tech Week, where culture, capital, and creativity collide. Today, Bumindi Francis, founder of UFCG, sits down with Dottavio Samuels, the powerhouse CEO of Revolt, a mission-driven media company. Dottavio lays out what it really takes to build the Black Disney, protect Black ownership, and shift the narrative of who we are. From media equity to hip-hop, childhood trauma to divine timing, this is one of the most honest, high-impact conversations we have had at Black Tech Week. And don't forget that Black Tech Week 2025 is happening this summer, July 14th to 16th in Cincinnati. Register now at blacktechweek.com. Let's get into it.
So, I'm going to do a little introduction. Zora Neale Hurston once said, if you are silent about your pain, they'll kill you and say you enjoyed it. While this quote was talking about the fraught, to say the least, relationship between white and Black people in the early 20th century, it does amplify the need for people to be in charge of their own narratives or they'll be misrepresented. In media today, there are a limited number of Black voices and even smaller amounts of Black-led networks, which can restrict the way Black stories are told. Dottavio Samuels, as you just heard, is the CEO of Revolt, one of the largest growing Black-owned media companies in the United States. Samuels will discuss with me today how entrepreneurship and leadership can control and change the narrative that is often present about us and our community. Welcome again, Dottavio Samuels.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. How y'all feeling today? Hey, can I ask you a question? Did anybody else get nervous when she did that whole intro about the safety and stuff? Anytime I'm in a space and they like, you need to know where the exits are and don't save the person next to you, I get nervous. So I hope y'all are calm out there.
But everybody knows where the exits are now, right? Safety first, safety first. So Dottavio, again, Yes. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Please start by telling us about yourself and what led you to Black Tech Week.
Yeah. Okay, so Dottavio Samuels, I was born in Boulder, Colorado. My parents come from two different worlds. My mother from the south side of Chicago, you know what that life is like, by where her family comes by way of Alabama. My father's family's Jamaican, but born in Costa Rica. And so I have both immigrant side, I'm first generation American born on my father's side, and I come from a long lineage of slaves on my mother's side, right? Both of my parents were educators, so education has always been something that was super important to me. After leaving Colorado, I went to Duke University, have some friends from Duke in the room. Was blessed there that I discovered what I thought I wanted to do with my life, which was to become a CMO. I got set on fire taking a marketing class, and I was like, I think I found what I want to do. And so from there, I ended up going to Stanford because every CMO that I saw had an MBA. I left Stanford, went to Johnson & Johnson, did global marketing there for a couple of years. And that was when I finished working for non-Black-owned companies. In 2007, I went to work for a Black man named Don Coleman, ex-football player. Don Coleman built the dopest Black-owned agency that was running things in the 90s and the 2000s. From there, I then go work for Kathy Hughes, first Black woman ever IPO, and her son, Alfred Liggins. I run their digital business and their agency business and a couple of other businesses for them. And then when COVID hit, I went and joined Revolt. And so I have the honor and privilege of working with Mr. Sean Diddy Combs, Sean Love Combs. You can always tell how people know him based on the nickname that they give him.
Or how old they are.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So for me, he's PD. So anyways, I've been there for 3 years. And then how I find my way to Black Tech Week. First, I believe in the leadership over Black Tech Week. There's two leaders who I think are just doing an incredible job. Even if you just look at the difference from last year to this year. And so it's important for me to celebrate and showcase and show up for people in the community who are doing amazing work. But then the other thing is tech is the greatest builder of generational wealth over the course of the last century. And I am passionate about making sure that my people, us, we don't get left out of it. Every single boom that has happened in this country, while we have often been a part of it, we have often been left out. And so they build the tobacco industry and the cotton industry off of our backs and we don't see the economics. You step into things like the new era deal, the housing boom, the gold rush, all of those things we're a part of, but we are left out of the story and the narrative. And so it is important for me that my people, not just because it's about how we build generational wealth, but also we now know the impact of technology, right? We can wake up and say, Google built the base layer to the internet and indexed it. Meta built the social layer, and we know the impact of that social layer on our brains, on our behaviors, on our activity. And so not only is it important to me that we have a role from an ownership and benefit from an economic standpoint, but that we have a role in designing the future, because the future is being designed by tech leaders every single day, and we just can't afford to be left out.
Wonderful. That's a mouthful. Thank you so much.
I love to ramble, so if I ramble too long, somebody in the front just
stop
me.
We're here to hear you talk. Okay. It's not a ramble at all. So in your biography, you often talk about growing up in the rough part of Denver and an experience where you were jumped by a gang and your mom moved you to the suburbs, where you were then surrounded by doctors, lawyers, professionals that inspired you. How did that affect or change your Black experience?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to talk about it on two levels. One, I'm going to talk about the importance of environment, and the other one, I'm going to talk about learning that Black people are not a monolithic group. Right. So as it relates to like this notion of the role your environment plays in the person you are able to become. So when you look at my story, so I skipped a grade when I was young. I wasn't gifted and talented. Fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, like all the signs of someone who showed high potential. But also by fourth and fourth grade, I'm cursing all the time. Fifth grade, I'm cursing and fighting all the time. Sixth grade, I'm cursing and fighting and stealing, getting suspended. So while I'm in these places that should set me up for success, my environment was playing a toll on me. It's when I first come to really learn and understand Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's like when all you worried about is survival, when you just trying to figure out how to get from the school door to your front door, like you can't be great. And then when my mom moved me to the suburbs, it was like, poof, all that stuff went away. And so now, like, I'm free. Now the only thing I have to worry about is being a kid and playing and doing my schoolwork. And so it showed me the privilege that comes and is associated with where you grow up, and how so many of my people don't come from those places. And so there are so many high potential, amazing people out there who just don't have the access to opportunities or the shot to be great. And so it taught me that. I also went to Stanford, which was like another way of learning that kind of lesson. You know, when you go to top business schools, y'all know the top business schools don't have grades. They literally don't have grades. We were scored on everything on pass, fail, and then they wouldn't even report your grades to employers when they asked for it. What type of freedom is that? If Black people could be that free, you know what I mean? So anyways, I began to learn the difference between where you grow up and how your environment really plays a role in who you become. The other thing from a Black perspective, learning that we are not a monolithic group, I just learned that every single day at home. My mom was, like I said, she Black, she's Southern Black. You know, that's chitlins and collard greens and fried chicken Black. But my father was jerk chicken and rice and peas and curry goat Black. You know what I mean? When you walk into my aunt and uncle's house, you talking about Black people who have darker skin than I do, who only speak Spanish to each other, who want to listen to salsa and dance merengue. And so from a very young age, just looking at my family, I was able to see how diverse we are, how beautiful we are, and how we don't fit into one singular box, though the world may try to box us in. We are not a community. We are a community of communities. We are a nation of many nations. And I got to learn that at a very young age.
That's phenomenal. I'm so happy you spoke to so eloquently the fact that Black people are not a monolith, right? And your experience growing up really gave you a really great, you know, foresight into sharing that with us. So being that you're in the media and we're talking about your youth and growing up, how does media affect children's worldview, you know, especially in the Black community, Black children?
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about it from a high level, but what I'll start by saying is my heart is broken that there is no Black Nickelodeon, that there is no Black Pixar, right. That there is no like Black Disney in the way that like young, you know, white kids get to grow up watching the Disney Channel, and my heart breaks because where the stories we learn, storytelling starts at such a young age, and then those stories become ingrained throughout our entire lives. And so if we do our job well, Revolt will create that. We will create the Black Nickelodeon. We will create the Black Disney. We'll do all of those things. But then to specifically answer the question about why media is important in terms of like generating our worldview, my favorite analogy is simply that media is mirrors and windows. For the people who the story is about, it is a mirror. It tells you who you are, where you come from, what you're capable of, what your people are capable of. For those people who come from outside of that community, it is windows. It is a window into that group of people, who they are, where they come from, what they're capable of. And the problem that we have is that since the 15th century, the narrative and the story, therefore the windows and the mirrors about Black people, about the Black diaspora, are funny mirrors. It's like walking into, obviously, like when you go to a circus and they have that like room full of funny mirrors, like every day Black people are walking, waking up, look, in a circus room, looking at a room full of funny mirrors, things that don't reflect back our truth, things that don't tell us that we are kings and queens, things that don't tell us that the only person we can relate to in media shouldn't just be the drug dealer or the angry Black woman. And so if it happens to us and that conditioning is happening to us, that same conditioning is happening to people who don't look like us. It is the thing reminding them that we are third-class citizens, that we are savages, that we are beasts. And that's why Revolt is on a mission to build the world's largest, most powerful Black storytelling engine powered by creators, because we need the mirrors and the windows to reflect our truth, to reflect our reality, and to tell the world who the hell we are.
All right now. That was beautiful. Wow. So in an article with Jasmine Broly at Essence, it's a great story, you talked about how you joined Revolt when you just lost your father. And you were thinking about legacy, specifically about your father's legacy. Mm-hmm. To quote you, you said that you realize a commonality between my father and myself in that he spent his career walking into white spaces, championing Black culture, trying to get people to see us differently, and that I had been doing that my whole career. He did it in an academic space, and I did it in the media space. So if you're comfortable, can you tell us about what your father taught you about Blackness that you carry with you today? Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'm comfortable answering anything that you ask, so all good. My father taught me to fall in love with my people and to hate our pain. And so my father was a professor of English and African American studies. When you walked into my father's house, it was like walking into Blackness. You're seeing artwork from some of the greatest people all over his walls. You're seeing statues from the continent of Africa all over his place. You're seeing books by Toni Morrison, Maya Angelou, bell hooks all over the place. So I was engrossed in it. And it taught me to love us. It taught me to love us for our nappy hair and our straight hair. It taught me to love us for our skinny bodies and our big bodies. It taught me to love us for being incredible kings that have overcome so much. It taught me to love our queens for being the pillar and the cornerstone to everything that, like, he taught me how to love my people. And at the same time, he taught me to hate the pain that my people were going through. My father couldn't, he finished teaching at the University of Utah, which is about as white as it gets, right? Like Salt Lake City's like 98% white and Utah's like 99% white. And it's not that my father never taught at Black schools. He taught at Prairie View, he did all of that. But ultimately what happened was my father, his theory of change changed, which I won't talk about. But what happened was my father learned that he couldn't deal with Black pain. He couldn't live in Detroit. He couldn't live in Atlanta. He couldn't live in New York. He couldn't live anywhere where he was walking down the street and seeing Black people in poverty, Black people struggling. He couldn't do it. He couldn't stomach it. And so, yeah, he taught me how to love my people, but he also taught me how to see our pain, how to feel our pain, and how to fight to be the change to try to eliminate that pain.
So it can be exhausting, right, championing, you know, Black love and excellence in these white spaces. How did you deal with that, your father, and how does that affect what you do at Revolt right now?
Mm-hmm. The note is about being exhausting. So my father's exhaustion comes from different things. My father's exhaustion was in seeing the pain, so he took himself out of it. My exhaustion tends to be in what you're talking about, like in the fight. I am blessed that I've worked for Black-owned companies since 2007, which means the majority of the employee base that I've been working with for the last 20 years has looked like me or been people of color, et cetera. And so one of my favorite questions people ask is like, how do you deal with microaggressions? Da, 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 da. I'm like, I actually don't have to really deal with them and haven't had to since 2007, right? Because I work with my people. So the exhaustion comes in the fight. The exhaustion comes, and I'll just name a couple of those fights. Like, what are the fights that make me exhausted? I'm exhausted by the fight of trying to build a billion-dollar Black-owned media company. It is an impossible act. It is an impossible feat. Now, we will go do the impossible, but when all of the money is owned by people who don't look like you, and you need money and capital to grow and scale, and you have to stay Black-owned, it becomes an impossible problem to solve. When you don't control, when the advertisers control the revenue, when distributors won't give you space on their platforms, like all of these things that are out of my control that feel like an impossible problem to solve. It also feels impossible to see my people struggle every single day and then watch so many people in the world not see it, not get it, not feel it, not relate to it, not empathize with it. Like, that stuff is tiring. So anyways, my answer for how I deal with it is self-care. I'm the king of routines. I swim every single day. I get a massage every week. I do acupuncture. I get a haircut just so that I look in the mirror and make sure I feel like I think I look good. I don't care what y'all think about. God is the center of my life and everything that I do. So I'm going to pray every day. I'm going to worship every day. I'm going to do right. So like, and maybe that's the biggest thing in the way that I deal with exhaustion. And this isn't intended to be a spiritual conversation, but I'm a spiritual being. And so the only way I can be is to be myself. I would probably be way more exhausted if I didn't believe that there was a God that would help me do the impossible. If I didn't believe that I was on a mission and an assignment that he put me here for, I would be way more exhausted. But because of him and because of my faith, I keep going. And I believe that this little company called Revolt can change the world.
Yeah, that. Fantastic. So, how do you champion Black people in Black spaces? Obviously, you're at Revolt. What's that work for you now?
Yeah. So many different levels. So one, we would say, so again, when we talk about the purpose, we would say we're here to shift the narrative for Black people globally. How the mission is by building the world's largest, most powerful Black storytelling engine powered by creators, Black creators. And so a big way in which we're doing it is championing and trying to build a new world for creators. Again, Black people have built so many industries. We built hip hop, which has driven billions, if not trillions of dollars across so many different industries, but we didn't own it. And so we didn't get to keep the lion's share of it. And so changing that world for Black creators that work for us, one, we see ourselves as a place to amplify Black voices. Two, when we do create creative together and we do create IP together, we ensure that those creators have some sort of profit sharing or equity in the work that we do so that they can benefit from the economics of their genius. One way of championing people is not just giving them their credit, but giving them the paper and the money that's associated with the work and the genius that they put into it. So we do that every single day. I always talk about like Revolt is really not a media company. We're an engine for transformative change. We just happen to make media. And so other ways that we champion Black people, last year alone, we gave $50 million back to Black creators, showrunners, producers, agency businesses, production companies. Most Black-owned media companies aren't even making $50 million a year, right? And we were able to do that just with our people. We walk into the room with brands and we fight. And we fight for them to not only give us the money because we know we're going to reinvest it in our community, but to create really cool programs that can help change the lives of our people. One of my favorite shows that we create, and we created it in partnership with Target, is a show called Bet on Black. Bet on Black is very simply a Black Shark Tank. The beauty of Bet on Black is that, one, all of the contestants are there together, so it creates this like fraternity, sorority, alumni kind of contingency, and they end up being family and friends and supporting each other through their careers. But the biggest magic is we give everybody capital and we take zero exchange of equity, right? So walking into rooms and getting a brand like Target to say, look, we're not just gonna make content and we're not just gonna hawk products, but we wanna build this thing which can change Black generational wealth is a big piece of what we do to champion Black people in general.
Amazing. So I want to talk to you about legacy, right? How do you define legacy overall? What is your legacy? What would you like your legacy to be, and by extension, the legacy of Revolt?
Yeah, I think that's the only way I can answer that question. But what you said at the end, which is the legacy of Revolt too. So I'm gonna talk about it on a people level and on a culture level. On a people level, I've always said, like, when I die, I don't want anyone to tell DeTavio's story. DeTavio's story should be told through the people I touched, the people I had the honor of serving, the people I gave shots that nobody else would have given. I want my story to be told through their story. So if you think about it, instead of a blanket that's like, this is DeTavio's life, I want a blanket that's like, this is Bronte's life, and this is what Bronte created. This is Sylvia's life, and this is what Sylvia created. This, and all of those are people who I just happen to have the honor to serve as a leader. I also just recognize that, like, the way that you can leave legacy as an entrepreneur, every single promotion, every single hire, every single time you put somebody in a C-suite, especially if they're a person of color or have come from a background that is not, you know, affluent, you literally have the chance to shift generational legacy for these people. And so every day, one hire at a time, one promotion at a time, I'm building what I believe to be my legacy. And then the last one is just like the piece that you just talked about, which is the Revolt side. We did not do our job if we have not gotten people to see us differently. One of my favorite quotes all the time that I say is like, if you want them to treat us differently, you have to get them to see us differently, right? If you want them to change the rules that they've created in economics and poverty and healthcare and all of those places, then you have to change the narrative for Black people around it in order for people to see our pain, feel our pain, and change the policy. And so the legacy that I'm building, we will know we did our work if the policies change, if people see Black people differently, if Black people can see us for how great and amazing we truly are, then I'll know. And I think the hard part of all of that is I won't know if I've built legacy until I'm dead or gone, or maybe if I'm lucky 10 or 15 years, right? But what I always promise my team is if we did our job right, when we're done with our part of the timeline while we're at Revolt, we will make it in the history books. And so legacy comes if I've created change enough for my people that it makes its way into the history books, which, by the way, they're trying to erase with critical race theory, but we're gonna be there anyways.
That's another conversation. Oh man. So let's go back a little in your professional career. Prior to becoming CEO at Revolt TV, you were president at iOne Digital, One Solution, as well as Urban One, a company that is the largest distributor of urban content for over 40 years. Their mission is to represent Black culture boldly, courageously, and unapologetically. Can you tell us about your work at iOne Digital, One Solution, and Urban One, and what transformations you oversaw?
Yeah, the interesting thing about my work and my way of talking is it hasn't changed. Like, I've been saying and telling these same stories for a long time. The difference is the unfortunate murder of George Floyd gave us a platform for people to hear and to actually pay attention. If you walk into my old office at Interactive One, the first thing you would see is a wall, a graffiti wall of a lion. And that came from an African proverb that says, until the lion learns to tell his own history, the teller of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. I've been telling that story since, and then my job was to put the pen in the hand of the lion. Black people, go tell your own story, right? I've been saying that since 2014. Revolt is doing the exact same thing. It's just that people weren't listening in 2014 and 2015 or 2016. And so much of my work has been the same. But what I will say, you know, while I was there in terms of the transformations that I led, I built an agency for Kathy Hughes, which allowed us to have the best idea game in the business, which allowed us to drive sales faster than other companies around us. I built her digital media company and helped usher them into the digital age, very much a radio and TV company, ushering them into what is digital. And the last piece that I'll say about that that's really important that might be helpful for people in the room is probably by the time when I was at Stanford, I decided I wanted to be a CEO of a fast-growing company. And so that's when you get like that dream, and that's when you have that vision. And then probably from 25 up until 40, meaning the time between before the vision came to fruition, I spent years banging my head against the wall because I was like, God, you put this thing in me and I'm not doing it. And I was frustrated trying to figure out how to get to this thing, this vision that I felt like was inside of me. And what I would say is when I woke up at Revolt and looked backwards, I realized that all God had been doing for me was preparation. He was preparing me for the seat. He was preparing me for the table. So as much as I might complain and say, I ain't talking about nothing different than I ain't been talking about for the last 10 years, all of that was preparation so that when I got to stages like this, I could articulate it in a way that people could hear. When I think about Revolt, which was a cable company and desperately needed an agency to help take it to the next level, I ran an agency and I built an agency and a media company. I know how to do this job. When I think about a cable company that desperately needed to go digital, I ran a digital business. I know this job. And so all of it, while at the time was frustration, ended up all being preparation. And I'm grateful for that preparation because it's what allows me to survive and, God willing, thrive in the position that I have now.
That's fantastic. I know someone was inspired by that. I think what I'm hearing is walk your own race, run your own race. 100%. Yeah, everything has a meaning.
Yeah, no, I was trying to see if I wanted to say something, but I think I do. Let's see if we can get there. Okay, so then the other one on that is like... when I was in my 20s, like I always thought that the fact that I wasn't that CEO was my fault. When I was in my 30s, I always thought the fact that I wasn't that CEO, I thought it was my fault. And I was having conversations with God, like, what am I doing wrong? And it wasn't until I realized, you know, I'll say Spirit speaks to me and says, like, you don't understand that this whole thing is a chess game and you are but one piece on the chessboard. Yes, I have this dream and this idea for you. Literally, I remember like almost like it was clear as day. But what if there's a billionaire that has to fund those dreams? What if that billionaire doesn't know me? What if that billionaire doesn't know you to be able to fund you? And so I had to start saying, okay, sometimes when we're not winning in the way that we want to win, it's not because of us. It's because the other pieces on the board are no longer in place. And then you wake up at 42 years old and I work for a billionaire who's powering my dreams, who's got a vision that matches my vision. I'm carrying his vision out, let me be clear, but I can grab his vision, enfold my vision and create the company that I believe in. And so that's just also a note just to say sometimes, like, don't beat yourself up. Like, sometimes it's preparation. Sometimes the pieces are not yet in place, but they will get there. You will get there on time when the timing is right.
Fantastic. So I just want to go back to, you know, you talked about having that CMO position, and it's not easy to take traditionally to take the CMO leap to the CEO leap, but we're seeing more and more of that lately in very small doses, especially, you know, Black executives in the C-suite. What are your thoughts about that, and how did that leap happen for you?
Yeah. I actually think that CMOs are super well prepared to be CEOs in this day and age. And that's driven by this idea that like CEOs, gone are the days where CEOs just get to sit behind a desk and nobody knows who they are. And you know, they try to drive whatever they can through the operations. So much now so like CEOs are the face of the brand. As the CEO goes, so does the company. We all know, you know, whether you're talking about Elon Musk or who, like, we know the CEOs of these companies. And so I think, A, given that CEOs have to be the face of the brand, which by definition means you're marketing, two, I believe that so much of building a company in this day and age is about purpose. And so, you know, back in the days, it used to be about profit, maybe profit and building a great product. Today, I think it's about profit, product, and purpose. and that your consumers ultimately want to buy from brands that are trying to create the world that they want to live in. So that's why you see Revolt when we're putting more women in our exec ranks and in the C-suite, when you see us in reinvesting in our community, when you see us championing creators, that's an agenda. It is a very clear agenda, as if I was a politician, that we are out there like beating the drum for, and then making sure that we are not only talking the talk, but walking the walk. And I think all of that comes from CMO training. It is literally marketing. It is understanding what is the world that your audience wants to live in, and how do you then build a business model that then delivers profit, product, and creates that world for them. So I think CMOs are like perfect for CEOs today.
I would agree. It's a lot of data and stories out there on that as of late. So I'm glad you touched upon that. So I think what we're doing here is piecing together your professional trajectory and connecting the dots. So I want to go back to your time at Interactive One and the fact that you conceived 1X, their branded content department. How was this important in the continuation of Interactive One's mission? Obviously, you left to become CEO of Revolt, but what do you hope your lasting impact of your work there will be? And how did that transform the way Black stories are told today?
Yeah, there's a lot in that question.
It was a lot. I'll make them shorter.
No. All good. I'm just trying to figure out where I want to start. It was mission critical for me to build a branded content studio the day I got to Urban One. In fact, in terms of my negotiation, when they first came to me to consider coming there, I basically said, I'm only coming if you give me $500,000 to build my own agency. If we can't do that, then I'm not coming, because I had a very big dream that I was on the agency side, that all of the agency work was shifting to the media side, and I wanted to be one of the first to build like a killer agency inside of a media company. And so that was a goal and that was a dream. I would argue we very much did that. We built an award-winning division. And so then when you talk about what's the lasting impact, well, when you have the people who brands are paying to create custom content, but they have our lens and they have our perspective and they have our fight inside of them, then the content and the work that comes out of it looks very different than if it would have come from somewhere else. What's up, brother? I see. the work looks very different than if it would have come from somebody else. It's intentional. When I think about, like, even right now, I'll tell two quick stories about my team at Revolt I'm so proud of with that agency. We did work for Frito-Lay. They gave us a check. Let's just make up a number. $1 million for production. Out of that made up number of $1 million, 91% of it went to Black people, right? So we can be so intentional about not only the stuff that we put on the screen, but we can be intentional about how we work with the people behind the scenes. My team just shot work for Comcast, a thing called The Link Up with Coco Jones. I don't know if you guys saw that. The entire team of women running that production are all Black women. Tell me a place and a time when you sit so like, when you do this, you can begin to be intentional about what you're doing, which then gives you stories about the work, from the award-winning work, because it worked with consumers, but now I get to tell about how this was done by all Black women. Come get us. You know what I mean? So anyways, the agency has always been like a key trick for me in terms of making more revenue, winning because you have better ideas, but the core crust of it is, give me that money, let my people tell my stories, our stories about our people, and then watch how I tell 20 other stories with the money that you gave me, and also make sure that my community eats.
Amen. Yeah. Applause. So Revolt TV was created by Diddy Combs in 2013, making the company only a decade old. Interactive One Digital, One Solution, is over 40 years old, according to their website. Their content reaches about 80% of Black America. What are some key differences in developing at a legacy brand or much older brand in a media network than a younger company like Revolt?
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges that you have as a CEO at a legacy brand is like, where does the innovation come from? And then how does the innovation thrive? Because a lot of times when you try to mix innovation into a legacy system, it doesn't work. The legacy system breaks and the innovation never gets its job to be off. At iOne, I was definitely the innovation center inside of a legacy machine and was always trying to like carve our little space out away from everybody else so that we could do the work that we were actually trying to do and believe that we should be doing. I'm trying to think, what was the core of that question again?
I think the key question was like, boy, you were at this media company, Black-owned, for 40 years, and now you're at a 10-year-old company.
Yeah.
What are the key takeaways? Like, what did you learn there that you're bringing here? Well, you talked about one of the key differentiators. It's hard to innovate, right?
Yeah.
But that was my next question was, how do you innovate?
Okay, can I finish that one that you had before?
Now that
I remember, I have a really bad memory, and I don't care. So like, I forget stuff all the time.
Ask the question.
We all just gonna laugh about it, and then we gonna go on.
On that, we're twins. I'm glad I'm remembering the questions I asked, but I also have some help.
One of the biggest lessons was definitely like the difference between like how you build innovation within a legacy company. But I will also say that one of the biggest differences that I'm learning here, specifically because of Sean Combs, is I am blessed and fortunate that I have a boss that only plays in magnitude. Like, if you aren't trying to change the world, the dude is not even trying to like entertain it. I remember the first time I took Sean Combs, the 5-year plan for Revolt. And at the time, I'm not gonna tell you what we were worth, but you don't even have to know what we were worth. By the time I'm thinking to myself, all right, I know this man only deals in magnitude. How much money am I going to tell him we can raise? We probably could have only qualified for raising $10, $15 million, but I wasn't going to go in front of him and say that number. So I go and I say, look, here's the deck. He says, how much money are we raising? I said, $100 million. He took the deck, he pushed it back. He said, dream's not big enough. Come back, go away and come back, right? Working for a boss that is only playing, like he's like, I'm not getting out of bed for a $100 million idea. That doesn't change the world. That doesn't shift the algorithm. And I think a big piece of what I've learned is just there's a difference between people who are building companies to build companies, you know, to make money, drive good profit, manage a good P&L. And then there are people who are building companies to change the world and to shift the algorithm. I'm watching Elon Musk right now. If you think about Elon Musk bought Twitter, he has such a clear vision in his mind and don't give a dang about what anybody in here feels about it or has. It's like this man bought it and he is willing this company to be the change that he wants to see it in the world. Forget the P&L right now. They losing money left and right, right? So the biggest difference that I've learned that I'm really trying to play in is like, what level am I playing this game on? Am I playing it on a spots and dots, CPM, P&L level? Or am I playing the game on a like, no, we can really change the world level? And I'm trying to get more of us to see and play at that level. That's probably one of the biggest things that I would say is a big difference here. Here we're playing to change the world and we all believe that it's possible and we all believe that it's doable. Otherwise we wouldn't get out of bed to do it.
And we're so glad that you are at the forefront of making this happen for the world and our community, especially. Very important. So in an interview with Yahoo News, you discuss how many advertisers have fallen short of their commitments to Black people made after the death of George Floyd. You state that about $350 billion was committed to entrepreneurs, Black suppliers, and Black media. While there was a strong start, as the years went by, the commitment dwindled. Why do you believe it took the death of George Floyd for many companies to examine their internal processes and biases?
Just because they're not paying attention, because they don't care. Like, you just always go back to that moment, and it's like, what did it take for people to see our pain? It took two global pandemics, a massive pandemic that forced no one could leave their home. Everybody had to be still. So like, you're not still, but you're still. Then on top of that, you had to have this moment happen because before it's George Floyd, a month before that was Breonna, a month before that was Ahmaud, right? So it's not that these things, these deaths and these murders weren't happening. is that the world wasn't sitting still enough to pay attention. And then it also took like the most grotesque version you can imagine, 9 minutes of making people who are finally still, because guess what? The NBA ain't playing sports today. You know what I mean? Like, so you got people who are being forced to sit still to watch and witness one of the most grotesque killings in the history of mankind. And that's what made people stop and say, oh, now we got to do something different. And the further we get from that moment, the further the thought that we have to do something for this thing gets from them. And so that is the danger. Like, it is so unfortunate to me that, like, in order to create change, the drumbeat that we actually have to have is police brutality, vigilante behavior, Black people getting murdered. Like, that's the only thing that made them see it. And even today, they refuse to see it because the world is not allowing them to be still. And so when you talk about earlier, like, what are the things that you're frustrated about? Like, that is another source of frustration, because you can't manufacture another moment for them to make them care. And so when you can't manufacture the moment, what do you do? How do you create change? How do you find allies? Every day, that's what we're trying to figure out. And the last thing I'll just say about that is, you know, look, I always say, like, Revolt probably has 150 of the Fortune 500. Where are the other 350? So now there's 350 brands that are not spending on Black-owned media, which means that thing didn't move your spirit. The majority of the Fortune 500, that thing did not move your heart or your spirit. And now I'm 2 years later, 3 years later, trying to figure out, what is the thing that will? And I don't know what that answer is. I'm also stuck
that
because...
That was actually my next question. How do you reconcile that?
Yeah.
You know? So continue.
I can't yet, but like one of my gifts is that like I'm good at solving complex problems, right? So my prayer every day is that I wake up solving the puzzles that God has uniquely put me here on this earth to solve. And I believe that if this is one of them, then he will give me the answer. Today, I don't have the answer, but I am searching. And one of the things that I'll just put out there, because if any of you guys can help me, I'll gladly take your thoughts. It's this idea that like us Black people winning is a zero-sum game to them. Every time they see a Black person become CEO, CMO, every time they see Black people get into college, they automatically think it came at their expense. And at this point in time in the game, I feel like the only strategy is one where you make them feel like it's a win-win, where you can convince them that in supporting us and doing what's right, the pie actually gets bigger. It's not a zero-sum game. I don't know how to do that yet. So if anybody has any ideas, I'm 1,000% open. When I get off this stage, let me know. But that's one of the biggest things that I'm trying to solve for myself, which is how do I get people to care? And the last thing I'll say is I'm especially afraid, because I am 99% convinced that in 2025, we will have a Republican presidency. And this has nothing to do with me being political. It only has to do with the fact that, like, I know that brands and advertisers play it differently depending on who's in office. When Obama was in office, the money was flowing. People cared about multicultural. CMOs were making, like, all these big, massive statements. The second Trump came in office, I promise you, it was, like, 2 months, all of that stuff was gone. Multicultural commitments gone. Heads of diversity gone. Y'all just saw that when the Supreme Court announced affirmative action, Black women from, you know, top Hollywood positions and DEI positions gone immediately. And so I feel like my back is against the wall. I have until January 2025 to figure out how to solve this very massive problem, because in a year and a half, my world on the business side is gonna look very different. So anyways, if anybody has any ideas and can help me solve this big challenge, I am more than open to listen.
That is a daunting task, yeah. But we're all in it together. Amen. You know, thanks for leading the charge. It's hard to pivot from that question right now, but we're gonna move on. So Diddy's mission is described as authentically telling stories, centering hip hop culture in a fresh way. Revolt TV has grown since then into a global powerhouse that allows for Black storytelling. You still wish to shift the world and ignite change by using hip hop as a lens to explore the Black experience. With that being said, how do we use hip hop as a lens in Black storytelling? And why is hip hop the lens we should use?
Yeah, I'm gonna back out of it. So the way that Disney did it, I always say, like, we're trying to build the Black Disney, right? So when you think about Disney, they've got everything from ESPN to Marvel to Pixar to ABC News to, right, you name it. And the way Disney did it was through the family, right? So his very first products were all things that were focused on animation, cartoons, Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Daffy Duck, whatever it is. And then through that tip of the spear, piercing that kind of family opening, they then began to pull back. And now you get ABC News, and now you get ESPN Sports, and now you get, right? So what I would say is we have a very similar strategy using hip hop. Why hip hop? Because hip hop is the number one most listened to music in the world, because Black culture, specifically hip hop culture, is America's greatest export. Because I don't care whether you are in the hood or in a five-star or Michelin-star restaurant, you probably gonna hear Drake. It might be Drake on some elevator music in the Michelin-star joint, but you're gonna hear Drake. So the fact that hip-hop penetrates the entire globe is key for us. The fact that hip-hop crosses over every piece of our cultural fabric, can touch business, technology, fashion, the opportunity that is hip-hop is massive. And so what we are doing is using that as the tip of the spear to then pull back into other work. And so you might see incredible shows we have like Drink Champs and Carisha Please, but then you start to see other shows like, okay, how do we then take these hip hop celebrities and have a wealth building conversation, which is why we have shows like Assets Over Liabilities. It's like Yo MTV Cribs, except instead of talking about the car and the jewelry, we're talking about how you got the money to buy the car and the jewelry. Where did you learn to invest? Where did you learn about the power or the difference between assets over liabilities? You have shows like Bet on Black, where we're supporting Black entrepreneurs. As you begin to see us pull back, we've got a hip hop basketball league. You've got all of these different ways and facets. The bottom line is hip hop creates so many different ways for you to puncture somebody's like their thinking, their brain. So I can bring you in through Drink Champs and you can see Soulja Boy talking that Soulja Boy talk. You can see him on the docuseries, but then you're also gonna go see him on Assets Over Liabilities talking about how we built wealth. And then you might also see him on my show talking about his real life experience and how he got there. And so hip hop for us is the core, but that's because we know and believe that it crosses over all boundaries, all locations, and the world is in love with it. And so therefore it becomes very fertile ground to do the work that we're trying to do at Revolt.
Yes. So we're running out of time. But I do want to ask you about venture capital, private equity, and you mentioned during our conversation the challenges of funding. And, you know, a century ago, there were so many Black media newspapers and publications. How do you keep Revolt Black-owned with these challenges?
Oh, Lord.
That is the loaded question,
because that, like, literally that has been the bane of my existence for the last 3 years, that the number one thing I need in this world to create the dream that we have is a war chest, and it is impossible to get a war chest and stay Black-owned. And so in a world where those are my two choices, stay Black-owned and do the work for my people, or go raise money from somebody else and become not Black-owned, I'm choosing to stay Black-owned and trying to find a way in the path, but I haven't found it yet, to be honest. Again, I have the confidence that I will get there. I have the confidence and belief that God has set money up somewhere, northeast, west, south, that's gonna come to me somehow, some way, that's gonna allow me to do what it is that we need to do. But that has been the most difficult part of this role for me. When we talk about the difference between the vision and reality, Jesus knew he was Jesus at zero, didn't become Jesus that we know until he was 30, got to do it for 3 years. I had the dream of becoming an entrepreneur at 25, didn't get to do that until I became 40. Every day I wake up with a pit in my stomach about the gap between the dream that I express, this Black Disney where we are telling stories and reminding Black people that they can be kings and queens. Like, every day I wake up with that dream and then I go look at the work that we're doing today. And I'm proud of the work that we're doing today. I think we're doing really, really, really incredible work. Work that even in 5 or 10 years, people will stumble on it and realize the incredible work that we were doing, even if they don't discover it today. But it is so far from the dream. It is so far from the vision. And I need one thing to solve that vision, that gap between vision and reality, and it's a war chest. And I'm struggling to figure out how to build that war chest while staying Black owned. But I'm not gonna give up being Black owned because our people deserve a company, a media company that is for them, by them.
Right, all right. Well, thank you so much for being here today at Black Tech Week. What call to action do you have for everyone out here today? What do you want to leave us with?
What a great question. T.D. Jakes, I'm reading T.D. Jakes' book, Disruptive Thinking, and he had a quote I posted a quote from him yesterday that said, disruptors don't choose sides. Disruptors don't take sides. They take over. In a world where everything is politicized, in a world where it's always one side versus the other, my challenge to the people in this room, to the beautiful, beautiful people in this room, is screw taking sides. Take over. It's our time. It's our turn. It ain't gonna last forever. Like I said, I'm like, man, I probably only got till 2025. So if you're not doing it now, like if you're not making those game-changing moves right now, I don't know when you're gonna get another chance to do it. Don't take sides. Don't fight sides. Take over.
All right. DeTavio Samuels, everyone. Revolt. Thank you, Black Tech Week.
That was DeTavio Samuels, raw, visionary, and unshakably committed to the power of Black storytelling. From building a billion-dollar Black media company to pouring into creators and community, DeTavio reminds us, we don't need permission to lead. We need purpose, faith, and each other. Also, thank you, Umindi Francis, for guiding this powerful and amazing conversation. If this episode moved you, subscribe to Road to Black Tech Week, share it, and leave us a review. And join the movement in person at Black Tech Week 2025, happening July 14th to the 16th in Cincinnati. Visit blacktechweek.com to register. Until next time, keep building, keep dreaming, and stop choosing sides. Take over.